Good morning, everyone. I'm opening a meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee on Thursday, February 4th, 2016. And we're going to start off with a work session, opening a work session on House Bill 4037. So we do have, colleagues, we do have a dash two amendment that's posted to OLIS on this bill. And I believe we have David Brown who's going to be talking about that amendment for us. So David, can you come up?
Chair Peterson, Vega Peterson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Brown, and my company is Obsidian Renewables. House Bill 4037 has a dash two amendment this morning. I mentioned it briefly in my comments on Tuesday, but I don't think the amendment was available. I know at least one of you was asking me for it during the hearing, and we didn't have it available. So now I'm going to go through it again quickly. It's a fairly simple amendment. The reasons for the amendment are to provide better sideboards and tighten up the application of the bill to focus on its objective of projects now that really are going to happen. So the first change was at the request of the Oregon Department of Energy to identify nameplate capacity as being on the AC side, not the DC side. The second one was to make sure that projects that had already been completed wouldn't be included in the bill because they wouldn't need assistance if they've already been completed. The third change was to limit the participation by any one developer group to 35 megawatts. The reason for that is, I think, good news, that since the bill was conceptualized and I started talking with you about it in November to today, it looks like there may be more than 150 megawatts of solar that could participate. And I'd made a commitment to keep the bill the size that it was. And so I wanted to make sure that there were a number of developers that had a chance to participate, because the purpose of this is to give a number of people experience so that we have a more active and vibrant solar industry. So that was the reason for the 35 megawatt cap. And well, then the final change was, it's kind of a technical change, but unfortunately, a lot of renewable energy projects for many years have followed a pattern of getting started but not getting completed. And that leads to a lot of frustration by the utilities because they spend a lot of time trying to plan for it and doing the engineering and get ready work. Frustration for the developers, obviously, because they never get a project, so they lose their money. Frustration for landowners who have signed land leases that never pay any rent, etc. So we wanted to make sure that this only supported projects that really happened. So you have 1 year from when you sign up for the program to finish. If you don't finish within a year, then you start losing your 5 years of eligibility. So if you're 3 months late, you lose 3 months of eligibility. And if you're a year late, you're just out of the program altogether. So that means that a delay by a developer won't cause the program to last any longer. And so those are the sideboards you put into the amendment.
Okay. Thank you, and I appreciate all the work that you've done in tightening this up and getting a lot of the sideboards in there. Are there any questions? Okay. Thank you. Okay. Representative Reardon, would you mind?
Chair Vega Peterson, I move to adopt the 4037-2 amendments dated February 1st, 2016.
Rep. Reardon moves to adopt the 4037-2 amendments dated 0201-2016. Is there any discussion? Okay. Is there any objection? Okay. If not, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Brady Peterson, I move House Bill 4037 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Reperin moves House Bill 4037 as amendment to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Do we need to call the roll or no? Okay. With no objection, the motion passes and the bill is sent to the Committee on Ways and Means. Good job, guys. Okay. With that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 4037 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4036. So everyone, we have the sign-up sheets from last time. I know that we had more people sign up for the hearing today, and probably some people from Tuesday aren't going to be here. So we're going to do our best to get everybody on there. But if there's anybody who is here today that did not sign up on the new sheet, could you please make sure that you do that? Okay. And so we're going to start off where we left off last time, and I'd like to call up Jason Eisdorf for and Angus Duncan to finish answering a few questions from if anybody has any.
Madam Chair, just real quick for the record, 4037 we just passed is actually the Sage Grouse Protection Bill for Representative Vince District.
No. All right. Good morning. Thank you both so much for coming back. So do we want to, we can start with just some questions. And so I'm assuming that folks have some questions for you guys were so kind to give your testimony last time. And I believe you both had a chance to finish. So are there questions for these two? Representative Whitener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quick. You brought up a lot of issues that I was concerned about myself. You guys do some great work. The thing I'm really concerned about is when we're eliminating one source of baseload power is what energy prices could do beyond this to the consumers of Oregon. So because we saw what happened in the last energy crisis when all of our power out of our gas turbines was being sold to California, the price of gas went through the roof. Newberg put in two turbines. They actually went offline because they couldn't produce energy because natural gas prices got so high. I'm just wondering if you see this as a concern and a lack of foresight in this bill to not have something else to fall back onto for base load besides gas-fired turbines.
Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Widener, that is a... there's a lot of futurism, I think, in this bill. Clearly the dates extend out to 2030 and 2040, and so there are challenges to integrate renewables at the 50% level. There's a lot of work, a lot of intellectual capacity given right now toward how to do that. And by integrating it, it becomes a replacement to a certain degree for the baseload if you integrate it well. And there are different strategies, continuing to have natural gas, single cycle combustion turbines, storage. In the Northwest, we are blessed with hydro, although Bonneville Power Administration believes its capacity to ramp up and down to integrate wind is beginning to max out. So I think one of the interests that the Commission had that I expressed on Tuesday was not so much that this is necessarily the wrong direction, but just to make sure that we are thoughtful about how we do this. And it seems easy to double the number. It's much harder to make that number work. I don't know that that's necessarily exactly the right answer, except that it is a challenge, and we will work on it for the next couple of decades.
If I may, Madam Chair, Representative Widener. As Jason says, it is a question that I think we all have a concern about, and we have a concern whether we make changes today or we don't make any changes today. The couple of distinctions I think I want to draw are first between baseload power and firm power. What's important when we flip the light switch is there is firm power available to turn the lights on. You know, historically, we've done that through baseload units, originally hydro, subsequently coal and gas units, in other parts of the country, a significant investment in nuclear. Those are baseload plants. They run all the time. They do need to run mostly at pretty full capacity, so there are inequities to trying to move those projects, those plants up and down. So we've got issues right now, and we will have issues in the future. But at least the best thinking that I'm familiar with about prognosticating the future is that, you know, our firm power in the future will come from resource diversity and resource flexibility, not from adding another baseload unit on. And resource diversity has always been of significant value to utility systems. You know, when we're all gas or we'll all hydro or we're all coal, we are very vulnerable to migrations in price, to variations in precipitation. We're all familiar with that. So resource diversity is critical. Resource flexibility, though, I think is the new concept that folks are getting their heads around. And yeah, at that point, we're talking about integrating baseload resources with peaking resources, with variable resources like wind and solar, with storage. And that only works if those variable resources, wind and solar and storage costs come down, and they have been very substantially, particularly just in the last 5 or 10 years. So that, I think, is what we are anticipating between now and 2030. Anyone who can tell you exactly what the system is going to look like and how it's going to operate in 2030 is also going to try to sell you a bridge. But we at least can look at technology trends and see where they are headed. And I am pretty comfortable that by 2030, you know, we will either have the capacity to integrate significantly larger amounts of renewables, or we will conclude we can't, and there's time to turn around.
Madam, or Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Widener, another issue I think that we'll all be looking at is voltage support. Frankly, the coal plants on the eastern part of the Pacific Corp territory are by virtue of their size and history, I suppose, provide significant voltage support on the transmission system itself. And removing those plants, it's not something you can't do. It's something you have to plan for and think hard about, and what you replace them with and where you replace them on the grid. And so, again, I mean, this is one of those things where it's going to take a fair amount of thinking and a fair amount of planning.
Absolutely agree.
Other questions, Representative
Benz. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I had a question about the transportation electrification issues, which I think you brought up last time. I struggle to understand how that future plays out. I don't know if the appropriate analogy is gasoline stations or if it's some other model that we should all be envisioning when we think about a future filled with electric cars. It seemed to me that since we have different utilities, IOUs and COUs and everybody else, there's going to be different methods of moving electricity from wherever we're getting it to people using cars, no matter what we do in this bill. This bill does not make a uniform approach to providing electricity to cars because we don't have uniform suppliers. The question, I guess, is, is it anticipated that somebody could go out and put up a set of these charging stations, just like they are would be gas stations, and then buy them up and basically have a monopoly on the supply of electricity to people that want to charge their cars? And the reason I say this is because I'm curious, which is the better model? Is it better that we have these utilities that are somehow controlled and we have to all buy the same price? Or is it better that we have competition and different sources of this electricity? And what does this bill do for that future is really my question.
Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Benz, That is a great series of questions. let me see if I can sort of tackle a couple of them. Let me go back actually to about 4 years ago when the Public Utility Commission responded to some of these issues, the nascent EV infrastructure development. And the utilities were interested in whether or not they could play in that area and seek cost recovery from ratepayers. And so I can't remember how long the docket was, but it was quite some time, probably the better part of a half year or a year. And there were a number of issues raised. One of them clearly was the role of an incumbent monopoly utility in a nascent, arguably competitive space. And so there were private competitive EV infrastructure investment firms, many of which still populate the turf. And that's why I think ultimately at the end of the day what the commission did in that order was to say yes, the EV market was still new enough that if the utility were able to show a benefit to customers from making investment in EV stations, a benefit to the customers based on investment in the electricity system, not the transportation system, but for electricity customers. And the market hadn't developed to a point where it was inappropriate for a monopoly utility to be playing there. Or if the by the monopoly utility playing in that space, it was dampening other competitive pressures. Under those circumstances, the utility could move forward. There has been little activity there, but not a lot. I will say that in California, I think they went heavily toward EVs several years ago, and they were going to rely on a lot of startups, sort of early competitive or early competitors, and it didn't pan out very well, and they did ultimately begin to go back to the monopoly utility and invite them to invest in the infrastructure. I will say one other thing about this, though, and I'm sure Mr. Bolton from PacifiCorp can respond to this. Scott and Varner and I testified yesterday in the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee on Senate Bill 1574, I think. We're agnostic as to how ultimately the legislature wants to move forward on this, but I will say that in theory, the theory of establishing the carbon price is the clearest way to connect and the most efficient way to connect the transportation and the electricity sector. And by doing that, if your goal is to reduce carbon, the most efficient and effective carbon reduction measures are naturally selected by the market, no matter which sector they're in. The EV directive in 4036 is a piecemeal approach. I won't say it's a toy, but it's not a sort of a comprehensive way to identify the most effective way to integrate transportation and electricity. It asks the commission to review plans from the utility in how they would build out the infrastructure. And I don't know that the utility has a whole lot of expertise in the best places and the best means of building out that infrastructure. And frankly, I know that my staff doesn't at this point. That would be an expertise that we would have to develop. So it is a, Angus can weigh in too. It's clearly a second best approach if the idea is to try to hook up the transportation and electricity sector.
So I guess a couple of additional observations. While I don't disagree with Jason that we're still at the front end of figuring out how this infrastructure is all supposed to work together, and the EV language in this bill doesn't pretend to particularly to reach as far as the vehicle to grid interface and how that can be optimized, because that's still a ways in the future. The intent, at least in drafting this language, was to leave two things. One was to allow the utilities to kickstart the deployment of recharging infrastructure, which, you know, other than Electric Avenue, is moving fairly slowly. And it's moving slowly, at least in part, because the recharging companies that, you know, are very active in California, where there's a lot bigger market, are not very active up here. So we're not getting that kind of movement. But it also, the intent also was to ensure that that ultimately, as the recharging market took shape, that it would take shape, you know, in a manner that allowed and encouraged competition and multiple suppliers and customer choice. And so there was language in there that enabled and directed the PUC to ensure that as the utilities deployed these plans, you know, they were going to enable those things, not frustrate them. And generally, I think as this infrastructure deploys, because it's beginning with a fairly standardized set of interconnects between, you know, the grid and the vehicle, they're one way at this point, but they're standardized, which enables a lot of different people to come up with a lot of different charger designs as long as they connect. They observe the protocols for connecting the grid to the vehicle. So I would expect that as the market develops and as we have more electric vehicles, we will also have more competition in supplying the fuel, the charging to those vehicles, and we'll have a pretty wide diversity of places where you can recharge, you know, at your home, sort of long term and slower, at your workplace, probably the same thing, you know, at retail outlets, you know, faster charging systems, so that you can charge while you're in doing your shopping, but a pretty, an ecosystem of different ways to recharge your vehicle, which will then enable more vehicles to go onto the street.
Very quick follow-up. Mm-hmm. The question is, and I think you both have touched upon it, does this bill dampen the enthusiasm for competition? Mm-hmm.
At least the way it's written, it is not intended to do so. And I guess I want to be careful with my answer. It is not intended to do so. We don't want to do so. I think, you know, anyone who looks at this honestly will recognize that if the private companies are unwilling to engage the marketplace in Oregon, and right now they largely are, that does open a space for the utilities, and that it's going to be important as EVs become a more significant part of the fleet, you know, for the state and for the PUC to ensure that head start, as it were, because they're the only ones in the field, does not evolve into a restraint on competition.
Chair Peterson, Representative Bentz, there is a provision in the bill that has the commission look out at the landscape of the market and attempt to determine if the utilities' participation is dampening the market. We have actually a similar situation with compressed natural gas. It was a very similar order. I think it was 2 years ago this month, where Northwest Natural was interested in doing some bilateral arrangements with fleet owners. And one of the provisions in that order, one of the conditions there was that in 2 years, staff would do an analysis on what the market looked like and how quickly CNG refueling stations were developing. And we did that. And so that provision is in here. It's not perfect. You know, there may be some regulatory lag there, but I think there's a backstop.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On a different subject, we, during the interim days, had talked about the ability to suspend the program and how that would occur. I raised a concern about how temporary in nature that suspension could be and whether we needed to put some sideboards around that. And we had discussion about the role of the PUC and at that time I felt satisfied with the answer, but I'd like to get it on the record while we're talking officially here in the work session. How do you see the role of the PUC to ensure that the temporary doesn't turn into a lot longer than we want?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Helm, I will admit to you, I think the commission's chair was in the other direction. It is not the commission's intent, nor would it ever be to undermine the program or the speed and the development of the renewables, the goals and the penetration. On the other hand, I think that, as we were talking about earlier with Representative Widener, there are, I think, pretty legitimate reliability concerns when we start getting into those levels of penetration. And when we first looked at the language, the ability to suspend is really triggered by one of the two utilities coming forward and saying we're discovering an issue. And the commission thinks that there could be other parties, for example, a balancing authority such as Bonneville Power Administration that's feeling overwhelmed with the penetration of renewables in their BA, in their balancing authority. Or beyond that, wider than that, across multi-state or even regional kinds of areas, and that maybe the provision was too narrow in being able to look out ahead and saying we need to do a check-in on reliability before we move forward. So clearly the intent would never be to sort of stall the program for the sake of stalling it. I think the worst thing that we, for the supporters of the bill, the worst possible outcome would be we sort of haphazardly stumble into something and discover we have a problem of reliability and integrity of the system, and that gets blamed on renewables and variable energy. And so I'm going to answer your question directly. Does the language draw an appropriate balance between the ability to trigger it and not allowing sort of a hijacking of the program? I don't know exactly what to tell you. The commission is operating a renewable portfolio standard right now, and I think we're doing a pretty good job. We're implementing it in the way I believe it was intended to be implemented. When we start getting into these kinds of numbers in 2028, 2029, 2030, I think they're the trigger to look out and determine whether the integrity of the system is being challenged. I think I'm not sure the trigger written down here is appropriately broad enough. So I guess I'll stop there.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Helm. So I'm going to have us all take a sort of a big step back and recognize that we are contemplating, an electric utility system that is, is certainly a cousin to what we have, but it's a very different beast, and it will have a very different shape. It is that distinction between baseload, firm energy, and flexible, flexibility-based firm energy supply. And we are talking about technologies. Again, they're not brand new, but they are a challenge to integrate into our system. So, you know, it's worth stepping back and recognizing it. In some ways, we are where we were back in the 1930s when we were contemplating developing a hydropower system, and we didn't know exactly how we were going to operate it, and we didn't know exactly what its capabilities and its perils might be. So it is worth our being, you know, prudent, not overly cautious, but prudent about moving forward to deal with this, and that is why the in drafting the bill, we kept the rate cap that exists in the RPS today, and added the reliability language. And in a discussion with Commissioner Savage, prior to the start of this session, he raised exactly the question that Jason raised, which is that reliability and grid stability issues are not just a function of, the PGE and the Pacific grids. We're interconnected. And so having a reliability trigger that is more expansive and recognizes that interconnectability of the system is a good idea. That, I think, is a fix that is useful to try to write into the bill the way it is. But the developers of it were very mindful that as we enter this new and different utility grid design, there are going to be challenges, and they may raise both reliability and rate impact issues. And we need to have language in there that basically allows I think one of the witnesses 2 days ago said, a pit stop. And I am perfectly comfortable, since we don't know exactly what the criteria are going to be that may trigger either of those two circumstances, that we defer that to the Public Utility Commission. They are in a position, I think, to anticipate as well as anybody else where the public interest is in jeopardy as we move forward.
Chair Baker-Peterson, let me, if I may, put something on the record here. I don't know what's going to happen with this bill if the language does not change on the reliability. It clearly is relying on the two utilities coming forward and making basically an appeal to the commission to do this pit stop. When we chatted with the utilities on this point, they said, well, you're the Public Utility Commission. You can tell us what the standards for looking out and determining when to ask the commission to do have a timeout. And so I guess if the language doesn't change, let me just sort of state my understanding based on discussions with the utilities that they think it is within the purview of the commission for the commission to, at an appropriate point, sit down, have the conversation with the utilities to say, you will come to us with a request for a timeout under a variety of conditions and under certain circumstances. So that is how it was explained to us. So if the language doesn't change and it's only the utilities that are making the call out, the timeout, that there is the role for the commission in advance of that to establish a criteria by which the utilities would look out and determine that a timeout was necessary.
I just saw some head nods, and I know we'll be hearing from some more utilities next. So,
Short follow-up.
Thank you.
Thanks for that answer. And just to confirm my understanding of the Public Utility Commission's process, if that happens, all the people that were part of the group and are here in the room analyzing this and chewing on it will have a chance to do the same in a public process from the Utility Commission. So it won't just be a conversation between the utilities and the PUC.
Chair Baker-Peterson, Representative Helm, thank you for that. I'd like to think that the Commission's public process is as good as we get in the state, and all of the people who worked on the bill are regular participants in our process.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jason, I made the statement, I think, on Tuesday, last time we were here, that largely we're doing this in February, considering this big issue because of the pending prospect of ballot measures.
that would do something similar, but in a different fashion. I'm assuming you've had a chance to do an analysis on the proposed ballot measures, and I guess my question would be, which scenario would you see being least disruptive to Oregon's grid and Oregon's electrical ratepayers? The pathway to the ballot box as presented, or this scenario that's in front of us today?
Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Johnson. As you know, as a state employee, I have to be very careful what I say about initiatives, so I may not say much. We've looked at the two, and they're different.
All right. Follow up.
Well, we didn't get far there.
Questions.
But it, I guess along the same lines, it it is kind of striking how it seems each time we get together, whether it's a long session, a short session, there's an issue du jour, if you will. And last session, we were all wondering about the 111D rules. What were they going to mean for us? How are we going to comply? What impact would they have on ratepayers and so forth? How do you see, now that they're out and officially, how do you see these two proposals meshing, i.e. the Fed rule, which envisions, I think, some regional trading. Certainly, there's a cap on coal. Look to the regions to figure it out, get it right, because they're looking for a number collectively, nationally, kind of a carbon number. But how do you see the 111D rules playing into this and helping or perhaps not helping the implementation of the plan that we have in this bill in front of us?
Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Johnson. So that is a great question, and I think we're thinking about that all the time. I'll give you an answer today, and honestly, it could change tomorrow. I mean, really, I don't mean to make light of that. The truth is, I don't think they interact very much at all. Potentially, the states of Wyoming and Utah and Montana, where these coal plants are, they are going to comply with the clean power. Assuming the clean power plan moves forward, they're going to comply with the clean power plan. The coal to clean portion of this bill won't change. Let me put this thing. Well, they will comply with the clean power plan and then operate those coal plants according to the laws of economics. If it's they're economic to run as against the market price, they will run them. The coal to clean portion of this bill doesn't alter that. On the RPS side, it does make the state of Oregon has to choose between a mass-based and a rate-based approach. The RPS rate—I don't want to go into the whole thing—but rate-based would a rate-based state would benefit from a significant build-out of new renewables. So the RPS sort of says, well, the rate base is something that we might want to consider. Mass-based is where a number of, I think, Western states may be going. And it in some ways is administratively easier. And so when I say tomorrow I could change my mind, it really is a balancing act or, weighing the pros and cons. I think that compliance with the Clean Power Plan as the law of the land is something that we'll focus on. The three state agencies that have been working on it will continue to work on it, and we will look to this, if passed, to see what those implications are. But I don't think there are fundamental – there certainly aren't fundamental antipathies, but I'm not sure they necessarily help each other.
And we're about halfway done with time, so you're going to have the last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is actually to follow up on the answer you just gave in the other day when we were discussing basically leaking. So if we're rate-based versus mass-based, and if we're at a mass-based, how do we handle, because it's a set rate for the utility, and if they can bring coal in from another state, leak it back into here, it increases their margins on what they're making. So do we have any way to control that to where they're not basically taking huge profits off of our ratepayers here in the state of Oregon? You see what I'm saying? Because renewable price is going to cost more
than what it does for the power that could be coming out of a coal plant on any given time, and they could be leaking that power back into the state of Oregon. Does that make sense?
Chair Baker Peterson, Representative Widener, is the concern that on that the bill sort of on its face says coal can't come in, but if the utility sells into the market, it's not coal anymore, it's market power, and therefore we can't. I think that is probably going to happen.
Because my concern is our ratepayers are paying more for this renewable energy, and they think they're getting it, but it's really they're also getting coal energy back into the market as well.
Right, Representative Wyden, we can't color code those electrons. That's correct.
Very quickly. So I guess two quick observations. One is I don't think it is a safe presumption that by 2030 the renewables will be costing more than either the coal or the gas. We have 15 years to go till then, but most of the technology and fuel trend lines suggest that there is, at worst a convergence, and at best the ability of these renewables to be more than competitive, with new sources and quite possibly with existing sources, especially if they're superannuated coal plants with significant reinvestment requirement to comply with federal and state regulation. So I guess I would at least challenge that. It also increasingly, while you can't color code electrons, there are, as it were, tags that get attached to power as it goes into the grid. So while all the electrons look alike, there are contract paths where you can track, what power is coming from what plant through the system to what load. And it's certainly not perfect at this point, and there is a system power pool where some of those things are coded and some of them are not, but increasingly the grid is moving to where those are in fact coded, at least on a contract path basis.
All right. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you coming back today to answer the questions. Okay, next up we're going to have Tyler Peeple, Bob Jenks, and Scott Bolton.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jenks. I'm executive director of the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. CUB was formed in 1984 by initiative to represent the interests of Oregon's residential ratepayers. Since our formation, we get involved in utility rate cases. We examine their investments for prudency, both big and small investments. And over the years, we believe we've saved customers more than $6 billion off their utility bills. We also advocate for sound public policy, and we believe House Bill 4036 is sound public policy. I want to address just a couple issues here fairly quickly. This bill does say that we can no longer use coal and use ratepayer money for coal starting in 2030 and 2035. It doesn't close coal plants, but it does more than just cause them to redispatch. What we're saying is customer money can no longer be used to retrofit those coal plants. If there's a retrofit required, we're not paying for it. If the plants need an environmental upgrade, we're not paying for it. If the plant needs carbon offset credits to operate, we're not paying for it. If the plant is subject to a carbon tax, we're not paying for it. Oregon customers will no longer be taking the financial risk associated with coal, and I believe that's a significant financial risk as we go into a carbon-constrained world. So coal may still exist, but we're not, customers in Oregon, Pacific Horn PG, won't be supporting that coal. I want to address the reliability issue real quickly. I don't think that believe that the trigger is really a significant issue. The PUC has broad powers. The PUC can investigate reliability on its own accord. If Bonneville is concerned about reliability by this law, Bonneville can ask for a PUC investigation. And I guarantee you, if the PUC does an investigation reliability and concludes that PGE's complying with the increased RPS is going to create a reliability concern, and that what's necessary is for PG to make a filing to start to trigger this off-ramp, PGE will do that filing. I've never seen a commission completely ignore a commission finding in the manner that that would suggest. So I don't think the trigger is an issue. The PUC has a power to make the utilities trigger if that's an issue. There's been some talk about the scope of the bill. I wanted to touch upon that very quickly. There's the terminal value has been one issue that's has been up of the creeping scope. The terminal value's in there because we're also using competitive procurement to keep costs low, and the idea is that the site has value and to make sure that's being considered. It's consistent with current policy, but because we're maintaining competitive procurement as a consumer protection, that goes along with it. The energy efficiency piece simply codifies current practice. There was some concern that if you increase renewables, the utilities will back off investing in energy efficiency. We don't want to see that. Energy efficiency is good for the region, good for the system, good for ratepayers. This just says we're going to continue to do that. The production tax credit is a change in current policy, but that's a policy that was directed by the legislature. Back in 2005, Cub and ICNU came to the legislature and said, we have a problem with utility taxes. Enron's not paying them. Customers are being paid tens of millions of dollars for PGE's taxes, but those taxes are going up to Enron, its corporate parent, and Enron avoids taxation, so those dollars are not finding their way to the federal government. The legislature passed a bill on our behalf that said, okay, we'll true up taxes every year and stop that scam from happening. That legislation, when it got enacted, when we started doing it, became extremely complicated and time-consuming. For each of the six IOUs, we had to have an annual proceeding that dealt with their taxes, their consolidated group, their affiliates, and it was an immense undertaking. And in the meantime, Enron got rid of PGE. So a few years later, in 2011, we came back to the legislature with the PUC support and the utility support and said, let's go back to forecasting taxes like we used to do, but we will allow the commission to look at the consolidated group's taxes in that so we can still avoid the Enron problem. So the legislature set a policy saying we now need to forecast taxes and not true them up. In the proceeding that recently happened where this was an issue, and it was a minor issue, Cub didn't even address it in our testimony, but we did address it in our brief in that case. And our brief said we can't true up the PTC, the production tax credit, because the legislature has said taxes are done on a forecasting basis. And that's what requires us to do the production tax credit on a forecasted basis. It's the 2011 law that we passed here, and if we want to change that, we've got to come back to the legislature. And so what this does is it allow the production tax credit to be trued up, so if we under-forecast it, it gets fixed. If we over-forecast, it would get fixed. In that recent docket we had, overall, the forecasting error was in the favor of the utility in the 3 years we looked at, not in the favor of the customers. So this will go back and forth, but overall, I don't know whether it will benefit customers or the utility, but I think it's a reasonable provision. Finally, I want to mention on the EV section. The EV section does change current policy. The Utility Commission looked at this. They opened their proceeding in 2009. The issue at that point was Ecotality was coming in and building a public charging network using stimulus money. They had to define what that meant. We had to answer questions like, is Ecotality selling electricity? Are they a utility because they're selling electricity to the public? And they had to define what's the relationship between Ecotality and PGE. The world has moved on since then. Ecotality no longer exists. They went bankrupt. A business model of selling, charging at Fred Meyer for 40 cents a kilowatt hour when I can do it at home for 10 cents a kilowatt hour didn't really make sense. So we've gone beyond that. The other thing that changed in 2011, the Pacific Northwest National Laboratories, which is a tremendous resource for us energy geeks, did a study, and that study said that if 13% of the cars on the road in the Northwest were electric and they had variable charging, where the utility could vary when the charging happens on those, we could integrate 3.9 gigawatts of wind. That's more wind than Oregon currently has. So part of what this section of the EV does, it requires that the utility is going to invest in charging infrastructure, that charging infrastructure be demand response capable. When you put in a charging station, making it capable of variable charging costs almost nothing. But if you don't do it then, going back years later and retrofitting that, or changing that, or replacing it, costs a lot of money. So we want to get the charging infrastructure demand response capable. This may well be the cheapest way that we can integrate those wind resources. And let's set the bar now and saying this is the goal we want to go with. If this is a potential, let's do it, because it will be at low cost if we can make that work. So that's a lot of what the electric vehicle piece was doing. So that's really the things I wanted to touch upon. I think the bill is affordable. It protects customers from the risks associated with future carbon regulation. It's broadly supported by residential customers. In every poll and focus group I've seen, the members I have and the group, the customers I represent, broadly support this bill. So CUB would urge you to pass HB 4036. Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Power. I've got a presentation here that I won't lean on too much, but refer to. And just for point of reference, this is the presentation, or largely built off of what we presented at a special public meeting before the Public Utility Commission last week. As many of you know, and are probably tired of hearing, Pacific Power serves 560,000 customers, retail electricity customers across Oregon. We're part of a multi-state regional utility that serves six western states. We support House Bill 4036, and when I had the pleasure to come before this committee during interim legislative days and we introduced the bill concept, I think we largely described this in terms as a good political compromise, a good political deal. What I'd really like to focus on now that we're in session, we're really getting into the guts of the bill, is that this is actually very good public policy and very sound path for the state to go forward as far as energy policy goes. So, moving along, hopefully. As I get technical help.
Yes.
So, couple of themes that I discussed prior. Thank you. This is our executive summary. The committee has these materials already, but a couple of highlights that came out of our deeper analysis that we prepared for the PUC as we compared the potential ballot measures that have been mentioned and this legislation. And first off, there are two overarching themes in how we see this legislation versus other policy choices. The first is time. The second is flexibility. Time has value. And under the construct of the ballot measures, Pacific Power would have to start disincorporating or removing from rates coal-fired resource costs and benefits as soon as 2023, based on the depreciation schedule that the Oregon PUC has currently adopted around those plants. That kind of dribble out of resources would occur up to 2030. Our estimate is that that's a $325 to over $600 million new cost to our customers to do it that way. And effectively what that experience is paid off coal plants that are reasonably low cost during that period of time would no longer be available to customers. And we would have to replace those resources with some other suite of energy resources. And that could be anything from a reshuffling of other resources that we have within our system to having to actually construct a new natural gas plant just for Oregon load service. So that's what represents that range. The other thing that I would point out is this has been a question that had been raised by the PUC and had been raised by other folks is, does this really reduce carbon? Our analysis is that it absolutely does reduce carbon on a net basis. It does reduce carbon on an Oregon allocated basis. That's a fancy way of saying, as we look at Oregon's carbon goals, basically the carbon footprint and the reduction schedule that the legislature adopted in 2009, this does put us on a trajectory to meet Oregon's carbon goals. But through the increased use and redispatch of our system around more renewable energy, we do have a net reduction of carbon emissions associated with this bill of around 10 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions. Representative Benz, before he leaves, did ask the question in the last hearing is, have we done the math? Have we figured out what that looks like per ton? And the per ton incremental carbon emissions benefit of this bill is around and below $5 a ton. So as we look at carbon taxation, as we've looked at cap and trade, certainly through the ambitious bill that we looked at last night with Senate Bill 1574, our conclusion is through the electricity sector for real tangible carbon emission reduction, direct investment at a time when there are cost competitive resources to switch out from fossil fuels to renewables is the lowest cost way to get there on a per tonnage basis. I'll let you read in your own leisure the additional
we have this on old
things here, but I am really screwing this up. Just a quick sense of our service territory. This is us in Oregon. Again, a very rural company. We have a lot of distance between facilities and customers across the state. One of the inside utility jokes is that you can get in a car and within an hour be at pretty much anywhere from downtown Portland to the edges of Portland General Electric service territory. For us, you can get in a plane and fly an hour and you're not anywhere near the edges of our service territory in Oregon. And that's important when we start talking about both the cost impacts around rural economies, as well as we talk about these complementary policies around electric vehicle charging. A lot of these communities are not going to have the type of critical mass to drive third-party market investment in vehicle infrastructure charging. It's going to end up being a partnership with the local utility in order to get electric vehicle infrastructure in these parts of the state. And as I've said before in other committee meetings, you know, we see PG service territory as the origination of a lot of the trips, but the destination may be our service territory. We want to make sure that people who choose electric vehicles, whether as a business decision with a fleet vehicle or as a personal car, can travel anywhere in Oregon. Back to the cost of the coal transition here, or what that looks like. As you'll see on the slide, the blue line is business as usual. This would be coal service to Oregon as we know it now, going out to 2040. You do see some of the effects of clean air rules hitting those plants. You see the retirement of plants along the way because these are older infrastructure. What you don't see is the full effect yet of the 111D rule applying to our coal fleet. And that's largely based on the fact that states are still writing the rules on how they're going to implement that. The green line is House Bill 4036. That is the 2030 end date for coal service to Oregon. And then the red line is the ballot measure. And it's really that delta between the red line and that green line that creates that several hundred million dollar new costs that we're seeking to avoid through passage of this legislation. Again, RPS compliance, this is really a two-part program. This is also doubling our renewables target by 2040. This is where the time and flexibility mantra comes back in play again, because given time and given the flexibility of how Oregon's RPS is already constructed, and the ability to time investment and to bank renewable energy credits so you can over-comply in some years so that you can smooth out stair steps in later years, gives us the opportunity to line up incentives, those incentives being included in this bill as far as the ability to get basically bonus banking provisions for early action over the next 7 years, as well as the extension of the congressional extension of the production and investment tax credits, which the shorthand of that is renewable energy is about 30% less while that tax credit's in effect than it was before. And so if we're looking at those tax credits, and I know we've had questions both from Representative Benz and others about how much development will happen in Oregon, we can look at pricing that we're aware of right now that with those tax extenders, Oregon Solar, Oregon Wind are coming in very cost competitive with new natural gas. We've got the Wyoming wind in there with no tax credit just to show how high quality Wyoming wind is, that it can be 10 to 15% better capacity factor than what we experience in the Northwest. So we have other options as well that are still, even without taxpayer support or that discount on that resource, is still cost competitive with fossil fuel options. And then the emissions question, as I said, we do see a real emissions reduction associated with this bill. This is probably the one state public policy on climate policy that really does, in our sector, drive emissions reduction. And again, it's because the more renewables that we incorporate into the portfolio, the more we're going to lean on those resources first in our dispatch models, and it will allow us to back off of generation from gas and fossil fuels. But I also wanted to hit another kind of argument that I've heard floating out there, that somehow there's some kind of one-to-one equation where for the more renewables we add, we're obligated to go out and buy and add more gas, and that's simply not the case. As we've done our studies and as we've looked at our experience over the last 8 years with Oregon's RPS and renewables policies in other states, and how we look at meeting both the 111D rule and just system operation and economics, we have plenty of system flexibility and capacity right now within our portfolio to be able to integrate new renewables without the addition of new major gas capacity resources, meaning that the gas that we already have, we can run to help shape our increase in wind and solar. We also have a considerable amount of hydro in our fleet, and then other market tools such as the energy imbalance market allows us to lean on other systems for resources rather than just have to plan solely for our own balancing. And that's huge, and that's great for the economic picture for our customer, but also the environmental one as well. We talked about reliability a lot already this morning. I think we can all agree, I think everybody can agree, that reliability and the integrity of the grid is paramount. Nobody wants to see challenges to the high level of reliability that we all experience in the Northwest. We believe that the reliability section of this bill is a new power, it's a new authority for the PUC to become involved. I think for this committee, it's also important to know that there is a whole stack of agencies and authorities who are involved in reliability. So bulk reliability, so the bulk transmission network, is regulated by FERC. So the federal government does have strong oversight over reliability across the transmission system. So when we talk about how is our system interacting with EPA, there's already a regulatory forum that's looking at that and actually has penalty authority for bad actions. We also have the North American Electric Reliability Council, which is a nonprofit reliability organization which looks at the nation's grid. We have the Western Electricity Coordinating Council, which is basically all of the transmission operators and balancing areas in the Western grid. And they have oversight for planning and reliability and, system audit opportunities. So there are many, many conversations around reliability. Our state regulators participate in those conversations, and absolutely, if it helps to put this on the record, that if we see any reliability potential problems that are a result of the increased use of renewable energy that's a result of this policy, we will absolutely go to our Public Utility Commission and ask them to direct us on how to make that filing to stop and have an investigation so that we can address those problems. This is the one area where I don't think that there is a real conflict as far as what people intend. Finally, there have just been questions around cost. How much is this all going to cost? We've got a really good handle on how much less this costs than the proposed ballot measures, but we've also looked at how much this costs relative to business as usual. And our forecast is, because of the tax credits that are available, because of reducing our fuel and emissions cost risk, we believe that for Pacific Power System that we can meet the additional RPS requirements over the next 15 years at less than 1% average annual cost increase. Now, some folks may say, well, you should compound that up. That sounds like there's something every year. Well, even if you did, we're talking 12 to maybe 15% total cost of adding a couple hundred megawatts of new renewables to the system. And just to give some scale, our inflation factor, so our inflation index that we look at just for cost of doing business is about 1.6% a year. So at about half the rate of inflation, we think we can incorporate this even as we manage other costs out of the system. So our strategy, just to put that out there, is to try to hold rates as flat as possible, that we can manage new costs as we can manage and work through old costs. Frankly, we're more worried about the inflation factors around health care and other and taxes that can actually have a more immediate impact on rates in the short term than we believe that this policy will have. So I know that's a lot, but I want, you know, it's the beauty of the public process is to be able to start answering some of the questions that get asked along the way.
Okay, well, let's start with that. Questions for this panel? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Scott, for your report. I thought it was good and thorough. Could you, we hear talk of cost. You just talked about that. And then we also hear, know about rates. What's the relationship between costs and rates? Are they equal? Do costs automatically show up in the bills of ratepayers in the state? That process for how we determine what actually people are paying?
It's a great question, Representative. Rates are the product of costs, but not all costs end up in rates. When we go into a general rate case and we set, here's our revenue requirement, here's the total cost of service at that time, we effectively get a budget. Here's your rate. And that rate has an equity component for any capital investment that we have an opportunity to earn up to. Certainly not a guaranteed rate of return, but you know, we'll set what we think our target profit could be under that budget, but we really have to live within it. Mm-hmm. Now, over the next period of years, if costs change dramatically, those are usually the triggers that create the conditions for a new rate case. But if you aggressively manage your costs, you can stay out of rate cases. And so if you do this in a way that is customer sensitive, you try to limit that customer experience of new costs. So one feature of this policy is that we do have a period between where the ballot measure would start mandating coal to come out of rates and 2030. Well, during that period, we will have coal plants fully depreciated. Their amortization of their capital will fall off. Those plants during that period will cost basically fuel and labor, and then some of the just the environmental costs alongside of them. And those will be fairly low cost resources during that period of time. As those costs come down with the depreciation schedule, our plan is that we would actually have some headroom, that you have a cost starting to come off at a time when you'd be investing in renewables and putting a new cost in. But if you do it right, you should hold that relatively flat or have a relatively modest increase, if any. So rate, people always ask, you know, what's this going to do to rates? And it's the right question, but I don't think most customers, frankly, know what their electricity rate is. But they know what their bill is. And the bill is really that reflection of cost today. And we're trying to keep bills as reasonable and affordable as possible.
Thank you. Representative Rudin.
Thank you. Not sure if this is for Scott or Bob, but one of you. So sometimes there's discussions about perhaps part of your service territory being taken over by somebody else. Could you, one or both of you, talk about how that would potentially affect rates, or would it affect rates, or kind of a concern there, how that might play out?
Sure. Representative Reardon, Madam Chair, the issue of service territory takeovers is a pretty bitter one, I think, over the history of the Pacific Northwest, because we have such a interesting mix of utility business models because of the existence of the Bonneville Power Administration and the federal power system that provides preference power to government and cooperative utilities. And that's, frankly, the legacy of rural electrification. Mm-hmm. Those business models emerged where, kind of like we're talking about charging today, where there wasn't the marketplace for investors to come in and start providing electricity in the early days of electricity. Today, you know, I think we have generally stability as far as who serves what portion of the state of Oregon. The issues around service territory take, and I would actually extend this as well to retail direct access, because Oregon does allow large customers to elect to be served by somebody other than their investor-owned utility. The issues around fairness and level playing field in today's world are really around ensuring that you don't have cost shifting. So if you have either a community or you have a large customer that has the option of a choice to go either be provided service by another monopoly or by a competitive retail provider, that economic decision doesn't create adverse economic impacts on the remaining customers who will pick up the fixed costs and regulatory and environmental burdens of that system, and especially where there's been a lot of capital invested to serve that customer or that community. We want to make sure that public policies don't create incentives to go and create that cost shifting, and that in those situations where a cost shifting can occur, that parties are made whole. So if a large company decides, I think I can get a better deal from a different provider, from a third-party marketer, they have that right under Oregon law to do so, but they do pay off their portion of fixed costs so that they're not making rates go up for other customers who are left on the system. And that same principle applies around service territory acquisitions as well, and has been enshrined since the original RPS in 2007. I think it's important to note there's nothing in Oregon Energy law or in these renewable laws, whether it's Senate Bill 838 or House Bill 4036, that changes the constitutional ability for a city to form an electric utility or for a people's utility district to be formed. Those laws are whole. I think the issue here is that if there is service territory encroachment or a new utility that is formed simply to avoid these public policies or to take a cost advantage because of regulatory mandates, that there be some equalization in regulatory treatment for that utility action.
Can I do a quick response, Chair?
Very quickly.
This is an important, I mean, the ability to form a public is an important way that customers can hold their utility accountable, and goes back in Oregon for many years. It's really hard to do. A utility runs a campaign saying no government takeover, no government takeover, and it's almost impossible to win a PUD vote, to be honest. But I think it's an important check that's out there. I've been heard it described as requiring the new public to have the renewable requirement of the existing utility as a poison pill. I don't think that's a poison pill. Right now, the renewable requirement is 15%. If I could form a utility that was 85% federal hydropower and 15% renewable, that'd be a pretty attractive power mix and pretty attractive from a rate standpoint, pretty attractive. So I don't buy the argument that that's a poison pill. It does mean that the utility would have to invest some in renewables, and that's a good thing. That is the policy that we're trying to advance with this bill.
Thank you for that. One other tiny one?
Okay, we have six panels, so very quickly.
Carry on.
Okay, all right. Thank you guys both very much for
very
your
much.
Questions. So next we have Craig Campbell, Tracy Rutten, and Beth Vargas. Welcome. You guys can go in any order, just don't forget to introduce yourself for the record.
Do you want me to go ahead? Okay. Good morning, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Rutten with the League of Oregon Cities. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 4036. We learned of this bill in late December. I think as many started to hear of the deal that was being made and reached between the parties involved. And I want to clarify, the League was not a part of those discussions and conversations. But it was a bit later in January that we discovered that there are some specific provisions of the bill that would have a direct and what we see as a very damaging effect on the ability to expand existing consumer-owned utilities or to form future consumer-owned utilities, including municipal electric utilities. I want to make it clear that the League's opposition is limited to two sections of the bill. We have concerns with provisions of Section 5 and Section 6 specifically. We believe these provisions will significantly reduce one of the only sources of competition in the market for investor-owned utilities. It also appears that these provisions treat federal hydroelectricity as virtually the equivalent of coal when you're talking about in terms of meeting the RPS requirement. And I'll get into that in a bit more detail shortly. I want to focus a lot of my comments on Section 6 of the bill first. Section 6 eliminates a current exemption in statute that would prevent a consumer-owned utility from having to reduce available, lowest-priced hydroelectricity that's available through Bonneville Power Administration. The exemption would no longer be available under House Bill 4036 if a consumer-owned utility forms without the consent of the existing private investor-owned utility provider. To more clearly illustrate the concerns that we have with this section, I'm going to use a hypothetical example. I'm going to go ahead and use City X as our poster child city so no one gets upset with me and I don't start rumors that they're thinking of forming a new utility. If City X decides to form a new municipal electric utility without the consent, so they're not able to receive the consent, essentially of the investor-owned utility, and they move forward and pay a fair market price for acquisition of that territory, they, under current law today, would inherit the same RPS as that large utility has. So that would be 25% in today's world and current statute. If the bill passes that we're looking at today, it'd be 50%. So that's current law, and I think there's a lot of people that would react and ask, how can a small electric utility possibly meet the large RPS requirement that a investor-owned utility or large utility would have? And I think and hope that this hypothetical example will help to answer that question. Obviously, many of these in our municipal electric utilities are serving populations that are relatively small compared to the large utilities. So we're talking about a few thousand, maybe a few tens of thousands of customers. So let's say for a moment that City X moves forward with formation of this utility, and they need 30 megawatts of electricity to serve their customers in that community. So obviously then if we've got this new RPS of 50%, their 50% requirement for that 30 megawatts becomes 15 megawatts under the RPS for qualifying renewables. Now, for a moment, assume that City X is able to acquire 25 megawatts of electricity from BPA. This is that lowest price preferred power, which is often a reason that forming a municipal electric utility might pencil out and be a cost-effective endeavor for that community. Let's assume that they are able to acquire 25 megawatts of that lowest price BPA. And I'll note that for a lot of our municipal electric utilities, a substantial amount of their portfolio is through that BPA hydro. So for many of them, it's upwards of 95% plus. So 25 is not a very large number in this example. So if City X has a 15 megawatt RPS and they're getting 25 megawatts of BPA hydro, and they need 30 megawatts for that community, it becomes very clear, I think, hopefully, this is easy math, that that would be more power than they need. If they've got 15 megawatts plus the 25, you're at 40. You only need 30 for that community. So that excess of 10 megawatts of electricity would be incredibly problematic for the city if it were not for the current provisions of ORS 469-A060, which indicates that electric utilities are not required to comply with the full extent of the RPS to the extent that it would require them to reduce the amount of available hydropower available to that community. So therefore, City X would take that 10 megawatts excess and deduct that from the RPS of 15, which gives them an adjusted RPS of that community of 5 megawatts. So now you've got your 5 RPS, your 25 of hydro, you're where you need to be. So again, Section 6 eliminates that exemption language when a new consumer-owned utility forms without consent from the investor-owned utility. That means that City X would have to meet the RPS requirement in full and would likely have to reduce the amount of cheap federal hydropower available to that community. So they would likely, I believe, take the 10 megawatts of excess and deduct that from the BPA number. So their 25 and BPA now becomes 15. So that's it becomes a very real reduction in cheap hydropower available. The League believes that the removal of that exemption language would make it significantly more challenging, if not improbable, to pencil out future formation of these types of utilities, unless it was, of course, with the full consent of the investor-owned utility. Municipal utility formation is already very challenging. It is not a simple task to pencil out these formation. It requires a lot of time, a lot of money, typically a lot of lawyers involved in these discussions. We really do not see that these small electric utilities have a competitive advantage over large investor-owned utilities that have, I think we're not going to be apples to apples with large investor-owned utilities. We're very different creatures. So I think that there are some really big policy questions here that we really hope the committee does take into consideration. And one of those is whether federal hydropower that's available, that's existing, and that is emission-free, should be displaced in order to have these smaller utilities meet a large RPS requirement. We also have concerns over Section 5 of the bill. I'll be pretty brief in my comments on those provisions because I believe that Beth will be touching on those. But essentially, Section 5 impacts annexation of additional territory by a consumer-owned utility if, again, that annexation occurs without the consent of the investor-owned utility. So, for example, if a small consumer-owned utility, such as a municipal-owned utility, were to annex additional territory, and that annexation was, let's say, desired by the residents of that area, so they wanted to be brought into a city and receive city services such as water, sewer, and in this case, electricity, and the existing electric utility provider did not provide consent, the entire municipal utility would be made subject to the larger utility's RPS requirement within the same calendar year. So I think, you know, there's a few issues. I know Beth will get into those. But we're talking about, theoretically, if one additional customer comes in and there's not consent in that scenario, that all of the ratepayers are now paying possibly substantially more, and they're all, I think, made subject to a pretty significant requirement under the RPS. So that does cause us concerns about the impacts that that would have on the ability for existing municipal utilities to expand their service territory. In terms of the amendment language that I know has been discussed, I have heard and had questions about whether it addresses our concerns. I believe that the amendment language, and Beth can speak to this, does address some of the annexation-specific concerns. It does not address the concerns that we have over Section 6 and that notion of reducing available federal hydropower. So I want to make that clear. And in terms of talking about cost shifting, when there is acquisition of territory by a consumer-owned utility, there is a fair market price. Like I said, there's a lot of lawyers involved in these discussions. And there are stranded cost methodologies through FERC that exist currently. So I just want to make sure that those things are noted for the record. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Vega Peterson, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. I'm Beth Vargas Duncan, the Executive Director of Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. We have 11 members. They are all utilities affiliated with a city. We do not represent Eugene Water and Electric Board. They have independent representation and are somewhat different from us in size and function. So I really wanted to note and provide some clarity so that folks understand the amendment that's been discussed. But starting from the beginning, OMU came forward early on opposing House Bill 4036 due strictly to the annexation issues that we cited. I do have testimony online that outlines that and cites an example and goes into some more detail that I hope is clear and helpful, so I won't reiterate that. But as I was speaking with folks about this, I learned there were a number of people that had not realized that this annexation issue existed within this legislation. So I brought that forward. And in the context that as cities grow, annexation is a natural function of the city. Folks neighboring the city may choose at some time to receive all the city services that a city provides, police, fire, water, sewer, and in the case of OMU members, electric services as well. The change that was proposed in House Bill 4036 does exactly what Tracy outlined in the situation for an annexation as well. So it would have a very similar impact. And by meeting that higher IRPS of the neighboring investor-owned utility, so if an annexation were to occur within a year, whatever that higher RPS requirement was for the neighboring investor-owned utility could be as high as 50%, the entire city would be subject to that higher renewable portfolio standard and within a year would need to meet that. So their choices would be rather limited in that they would either need to reduce their purchases from Bonneville Power, if that's possible, purchase more power than they needed, or buy renewable energy credits, all of which would be a very high cost. So I've spoken with the investor-owned utilities and others, and we did come to an agreement on an amendment that just addresses the issues of OMEU cities operating utilities. And so I'm happy to answer questions on that. I appreciate everyone's willingness to hear our concerns and to address them through this the amendment, which I do understand is posted as of this morning. I think the committee may have, right before we started, so it's available for view.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of Umatilla Electric Cooperative. And at this point in time, we're unable to support House Bill 4036. And I wanted to go over the two primary reasons why we're in that position. Because the two previous speakers have already started along the lines of one of the issues that is of concern to us, I'll start with that. It's around the non-consensual acquisition of service territorial language in Section 5, Subsection 5. And the issue that we have is that while the language protects from a non-consensual acquisition for an electric company, under that definition, we're not included as a cooperative. And so basically, the solution to that is fairly simple. It's what's good for the goose is good for the gander if we can be included in that, realizing if there's some arrangement that can be made that meets the agreement of us, the investor-owned utilities, the municipal folks as well. That would be fantastic. That would be the best way to get through that process. But at this point in time, to create a protection for one type of electric utility without providing it for similarly situated utilities creates some concerns for us. So that's one of the issues that we would like to see addressed in the bill. The second one, and one that has actually been a longer-standing issue for Umatilla Electric Utility, deals with the definition of a large utility and how a small utility transitions into becoming a large utility and having to meet the large utility requirements under the bill. I'm thankful that at least the folks who negotiated the bill sought to keep us from going into the new higher level of renewable portfolio standard that will be expected of the investor-owned utilities. But the reality is that the definition that was originally put in the renewable portfolio standard to become a large utility, which was a 3% threshold for the statewide electric services, creates something of the old Sesame Street rhyme, one of these things just doesn't belong here. Umatilla Electric is, by comparison, very small by comparison to the investor-owned utilities that are the large utilities. And it doesn't really make a great deal of policy sense for Umatilla to become a large utility under the renewable portfolio standard. We're a non-emitting utility. We're taking efforts to try and get renewable generation, but the truth of the matter is we're just not large enough to afford our own large generation. And so what we're hoping is that there may be some amendments that would address that issue. The idea that we have been forwarding is adding a generation requirement so that if you have ownership of generation that is not a renewable, then you can become a large utility if you go over that 3% threshold. The reason we did that is very simply to make sure that if anyone wants to develop a renewable under the renewable portfolio standard for generation, they shouldn't be disincentivized to do so. And so we wanted to make sure that that kind of perverse disincentive didn't get into the bill. But those are the issues that we're dealing with, and I, of course, can go through numbers of comparison about why we're so much smaller and different. The bottom line is that most of our customers are farmers and irrigators. They work very hard, and they don't make a mint doing it, and to add an additional burden upon them by making us comply with a higher renewable portfolio standard cost is problematic without a good policy reason to do so. And no one foresaw that the reason why we've become above 3% was going to occur. We are in a part of the state where we were fortunate enough to get a couple of large server farms. They don't add to the population, but they do add quite a bit of energy need. And so we have to provide that energy need, and we're happy to do it. But what it does do is it suddenly increases our need to sell that energy, and then it put us into the large category. I think originally when this was put in place, the assumption was that as populations grow and shifted throughout the state, some areas would naturally grow to become larger utilities because their population base grew. And that's not the case for us. So the anticipated use of that transition to large utility really has never come about, but a perverse effect has. And so we're asking that this bill is an opportunity to address that problem, and that would get us into a position of support for the bill if those issues were resolved. And I thank the committee for your time and would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to kind of follow up on a question that Representative Johnson asked the PUC earlier, you prefer this or the ballot measure that could be possibly on the ballot?
Chair Vega Peterson and Representative Widener, as an employee of the League of Oregon Cities, I am a public employee, and so I am going to opt to not talk about a ballot measure or potential ballot measure, just as I've been instructed by our attorneys that we could get in a lot of trouble. So I'd be happy to try and provide any information on it, which we can provide, but I would want to run it by our attorney first.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Widener, I think we're going to be looking to Craig Campbell on this one. I am also a public employee and so cannot comment on ballot measures.
The high store for answer.
Madam Chair, Representative Widener.
Craig, let the lobbyists take charge.
Allow me to go forth where no one else dare. It's clear that the provisions of the ballot measure create significant challenges for a lot of folks, including Umatilla Electric Cooperative, in the way that it deals with our ability to store RECs. And without that ability that was in an agreement we made previously in this set of statutes, it would make our ability to comply with the renewable portfolio standard dang near impossible and very costly. On the other hand, from our perspective, while we certainly do not want that ballot measure going forward, we look at this bill as an opportunity to instill some good policy while there's an opportunity for a legislative body that has the ability to have discussion and input to thoughtfully put new language into statute. And so we look to this bill as a way to resolve some issues that we couldn't otherwise. While unfortunately our initiative process, it tends to give you a yes-no choice, which is why, at least in my opinion, the legislative process is preferable.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you all very much. Okay, next panel we have Diane Henkels, Joel Fisher, and Mark Nelson.
Madam Chair, if I could come up with J.L. Wilson and Tyler, who were on the list.
Yes, I have J.L. Wilson, and Tyler was already called up. No, why don't you come up? No. Okay. Go ahead.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher, here on behalf of Oregon Business Association. We're a statewide association representing over 300 members all across Oregon, both big and small. We'd like to applaud the different parties that have come together to strike a deal that would keep a ballot measure off the ballot. We think that the deal that's been struck is better than the one that's on the ballot measure. We have a committee, kind of similar to yours, a committee process that we go through where we've heard people on all sides of this issue come and talk about the pros and cons. So it's gone through a very thorough vetting process at the Oregon Business Association. We support this bill in that it will increase the RPS to 50%, eliminate coal by, I believe it's 2030, and also have some protections in there maintaining the 4% cost cap. So we urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, thank you very much for taking time to hear our comments today. My name is Diane Henkels. I represent Small Business Utility Advocates. We are a nonprofit organization that represents small business interests in energy and regulatory proceedings. We have, I have submitted written comments, and I did provide paper copies today, as I imagine my comments are going to be within 3 minutes, just to highlight a few things. I do provide background in my written comments of who we are, the makeup of SBUA in Oregon. I describe how we have intervened in Public Utilities Commission proceedings. I also describe the profile of small business and energy in Oregon, giving some certain statistics. The statistics are publicly available, and I'm happy to provide the background. In fact, they can be found in public utility proceeding filings. I would like to just note a few things. One is, and I really appreciate the legislature's ability to access information remotely. I could not be here today but for that, and I was able to learn some more from the Public Utilities Commission special meeting on this topic the other day. We would like to say that SBUA is all for reducing carbon emissions, mindful, of course, of the WEC-wide reduction and leakage issues that have garnered a bunch of discussion here. And we really support Oregon's leadership effort that would result in a healthy economy and environment. We propose means by which we think the mechanics of this bill could be better melded with the policy, and I would say that we get fairly specific. We focus on increasing the energy efficiency as the least cost, least risk measure, and avoiding and going beyond the business as usual, which is how this was described in the Public Utility Commission proceeding. We also focus on the legislature actually seeing coming to fruition with the goal of the 8% community renewables, and that way we support the Community Renewable Energy Association's amendment, I believe they proposed to this bill. And we also want to acknowledge that the small business community, there's a variety of rates. The small business community, I don't know if you'd call us a community, but we have a substantial amount of the commercial makeup of the state, and you can see we're not represented in these proceedings, and so we address that issue in these comments. And we make specific comments regarding Section 1.5, the used and useful provision, cost recovery in Section 9, Section 17, as I mentioned earlier, energy efficiency. And conclude, we think this is a great, exciting endeavor, and we hope that these comments will help the efforts along, and we're happy to be available as technical or other resource. Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Mark Nelson. I represent the Oregon Mills Industry Council, as well as other industrial electrical users. What I provided for you today is there's been a lot of discussion about we must add, as we go into the future, added capacity to our electrical system, and that is very accurate. But one of the questions faced with you in this bill as to what are you going to add in terms of the system? We have a 25% RPS requirement now. We're up to about 15%, and we have until 2025 to meet that 25%. But the issue here is, do we need additional RPS capacity? And I think the cost, which have been bandied around quite a bit in this process, are very important. So I brought to you some actual cost that exist out in this system as a result of the 2007 wind RPS. You have the Tucannon Wind Farm. It's a PGE project. It's 266.8 megawatts. You have what's called the Cardi Combined Cycle Natural Gas Plant, also a PGE project, 440 megawatts. The net actual capacity of the wind farm runs about 37% because the wind doesn't, as you all know, blow all the time. That gives that particular unit a net of 98 megawatts. On the natural gas side, the estimate by PGE in their annual documents with the state puts it at about 70%. Others believe that's higher, but I use that conservative number. Both of them cost in all in the range of the same number, $524 million versus $514 million. So all in the same cost. But PGE would have to build 3.14 similar wind farms at a cost of $1.67 billion to match the kilowatt production of the one Cardi gas plant, which cost only $514 million. And again, these are actual numbers and actual plants, not theoretical, that we talked about in 2007 and we continue to talk about, as we should, moving into a second RPS. Now let's take those numbers and extrapolate them. The difference between, of course, the 1.647 to build 3.14 new plants to match the Cardi and the 514 that it cost to build the Cardi is $1.133 billion. The difference in the production of these two facilities, if in fact you had to match them, make them equal, is $1.133 billion. Now, those costs all go into rates. And one fashion or another, as Mr. Bolton has indicated, there are other things, capital costs, and those other kinds of variables that go in. If you take, and the testimony by the IOUs, if I remember right, or maybe it was renewable people, is that they estimate that you're going to need 3,000 more megawatts to meet this new RPS standard. If that's the case, and keep in mind we're at 3,000 now, but we're only at 15%, but I think there are things being built or in the pipeline now, so I'm not sure about that number. But if you take 3,000 megawatts, which we have to produce, and we're limiting it to the renewables, not gas-fired, you need to take that number out. Okay, what's it going to cost to build that 3,000? Because they have to be, in this case, I use this the wind as an example. It's going to cost $16.05 billion to build the 3,000 megawatts. If you did the natural gas plants, you say you did them all with natural gas, that's going to be 5.006. The difference being $11.04 billion. Again, I wanted to bring these actual costs to you. These, in making your decision, it doesn't mean they don't build any renewables or they only build gas-fired. It's a policy decision that you make. But I think that needs to be made in terms of what the costs have been so far in this kind of an example. So, again, the ability to, when you take this bill and do what you're doing in terms of limiting the choices, I think there's a balance there. I don't think it's all one. I don't think it's all the other. And part of your question is, well, is 25% enough? Have we done enough? I think many in this room believe, well, no, we haven't. Many in this room believe, yes, these kinds of numbers you have at these kinds of costs, over $1 billion just between these two plants, that you have done enough. So, again, to put that for, before you, be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel?
I'm sure. Yeah.
Representative Widener.
Thank you. And, Mark, actually, thank you for this here. I mean, it's helpful. And even coming into committee today, I was sitting here feeling like basically as a legislature, we're being held hostage on making policy sometimes. And it's like, well, shoot, are we going to get shot in the chest or do we want to get shot in the leg? And I feel like this legislation's us taking a choice of being shot in the leg rather than being shot in the chest. And I think it makes it hard for us to come up with good policy. And I just wonder, with all the effort you've put into this, is there anything you've done? Because I'm very much into solutions for putting this stuff together. I brought in, had us look at nuclear power, different things like that. If we wouldn't be better served putting together a team to actually come up with very effective way of dealing with our carbon footprint and keeping the costs down, because our ratepayers are going to lose that benefit of these depreciated out coal-fired plants because they're paid for. Now it doesn't cost anything and the rates should be coming down, but instead we're putting more renewables online and taking that money and moving it over here, so our ratepayers never see a reduction. And I'm just wondering if
any of your groups have put together a team like that to where we can start actually making very good policy for taking care of ratepayers and the environment.
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, I think there is, but it's not what everyone wants, obviously. I think you box yourself when you require that you must do this, that this is where you're going to go. And you can see what the impact is if you require. You know, I think people are into renewables. I don't think you have to require them to build wind farms. There are enough tax credits, enough kind of benefits out there that people can build them. They also have to be competitive. So I don't think it's either or. I think you want to continue to develop gas-fired plants. I think you want to continue to develop wind, solar, all of those. But when you do this, who's going to pay that price? I can tell you industry is not willing to pay that price. And to answer your question about ballot measures, my attitude is bring it on. These kinds of numbers, you won't pass a ballot measure like that. It won't happen. It will not happen. So a ballot measure is just an excuse to do other things, which this bill does many things, which you'll hear about.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
For next up, we have Jeremy Anderson, Ann Smert, and Kristen Sheeran. Go ahead and start in any order.
Very short on time. Madam Chair, committee members, good morning. My name is Jeremy Anderson. Excuse my cold. I represent WISE. We are a trade association of weatherization contractors, distributors, and manufacturers. In listening to testimony over the 4 hours or so that we've heard so far, it comes up time again that we want to reduce carbon emissions. We want to do it at a low cost. We want to do it maintaining reliability. And if possible, we want to keep some of the ratepayer money in Oregon's economy. Efficiency is the way to do that. We're not going to get all the way there through efficiency, but on all three of those criteria, we beat any other proposal by a mile. That's why I'm here in strong support of Section 17. Section 17 prioritizes energy efficiency. However, three times now, we have heard testimony that it's business as usual, is how that's being interpreted. Business as usual is not getting us where we need to go on efficiency. So, I would ask that if it's the committee's and the legislature's intention to prioritize efficiency, which again, is going to be significantly less expensive, it's going to keep money here in Oregon, and is as reliable as you can get, then make sure that the intention is followed through in Section 17 to actually prioritize energy efficiency. And you have my written comments on some ideas for how to do that. But thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Smert, and I'm the Director of Government Relations and Regulatory Affairs for ChargePoint. We're the world's largest network of electric vehicle charging stations. I'm here today. We fully support the clean energy goals of this bill, but we have some concerns about the EV charging station language here, and we think a few small changes to this bill will really help strengthen that section. We've sold more than 26,000 charging stations around the country. We've had experience working with utilities in many states through regulatory process to ensure that competition, customer choice, and innovation are protected as we allow for the new role for utilities. It has been stated here today that the private sector has left Oregon or has no interest in installing stations here, and that could not be further from the truth. I wouldn't be here today if our investors and board members didn't fully believe that some amendments to this bill is necessary to ensure that we can continue to have a future here in the state. I also think it's important to note that CUB made some comments about the impact of the market from Ecotality receiving funding through the Federal ERA program to provide free stations here in Oregon. The impact of that program was that it pushed out other competitors and caused the market to really struggle as a result. We're now getting to a new place where we are able to compete and there isn't something out here for free. However, as written without protections, this bill could allow us to repeat history, in this case with the utility playing the role of the federal government. We think there's some great parts of this bill, which we think is important to point out. First and foremost, we support a role for the utilities in transportation electrification. They're partners here as we're switching fuel sources. It's very important the utilities know what load is coming online and have the ability to ensure that technologies are demand response capable and capable of providing smart charging. We also believe, of course, that transportation electrification should be a goal of the state. And we appreciate the intent language in the bill that stimulates innovation, competition, and will attract private capital and create high-quality jobs in Oregon. Unfortunately, this language is primarily limited to the intent section of the bill, which we believe provides limited, if any, legal backing at the Public Utilities Commission to require these elements to be a part of the utility applications. This point was made by the PUC last week or on Tuesday as well. So we think a few small changes to the bill could drastically improve this section and help ensure that the goals of the legislation are actually achieved. First and foremost, we believe that we should open a proceeding at the Public Utilities Commission. As written, this bill requires that the commission direct utilities to file applications to either own and operate charging stations paid for by ratepayers or to provide customer rebates for charging equipment. And as a monopoly, utilities have the ability to rate-base charging stations and install them free of charge for customers. If designed poorly with limited regulatory oversight, these programs could have drastic long-term damaging impacts on the market. If there's something available to be installed free of charge by the utility, it's obviously difficult for us to sell a station to that same customer. We also think that a thoughtful PUC process will help us to develop stronger utility programs. It was mentioned that California recently approved two applications by San Diego Gas and Electric and Southern California Edison to invest ratepayer funds in charging infrastructure. We've supported both these applications because they contain elements of customer choice, protecting competition, and our ability to sell in those territories. They were also done through a thoughtful process to ensure prudence and with an appropriate role for the utility with a record that we believe will be absent from the process outlined here in the bill. We also know that the utilities are currently able to file applications at the PUC, as has been noted from the 2012 decision. And to date, no utility application has been filed. We're concerned that in erasing this decision and this history, we're erasing the ability to revisit past record and look at what happened in the market over the past few years. We also think they should prioritize investments in low-income communities. As we're using ratepayer funds, it's important to ensure that these funds are being used for all customers, particularly for areas where we currently don't have driver adoption. Though the bill identifies an intent to increase access to electricity as a use for transportation fuel in low-income communities, there is no requirement that stations be sited in these communities, and there is no requirement that funding be used for education and outreach for EV adoption. We think that those elements should be a requirement, not just an intent of any utility program. Thirdly, it's important that we strengthen the protections for competition and customer choice. Though there is intent language in Section 18 that supports increased options in the use of charging equipment, there is no language requiring the utility programs to allow site hosts to have their choice in equipment and services. We believe that customer choice is vital to ensure that the market have multiple players, not just one vendor. And we believe that this will strengthen the industry in the long run. We want there to be more charge points in the world, and we believe that overall that will reduce the risk of ratepayers if one of our competitors goes under. We also firmly believe that site hosts should be able to choose the equipment and technology most appropriate for that site. This is not a one-size-fits-all model. There's many different business models out in the market today, and it's important that each site have the ability to look at their drivers, figure out what pricing makes the most sense. If they want to offer free charging for their employees and pay their electricity bill appropriately, then that site should have the ability to do so. If they want retractable cords so that people don't trip over them in their parking garage, they should have the ability to do so. As currently written, this bill could allow the utilities to procure the cheapest, most basic equipment, which could damage drivers and EV adoption in the long run. We think one small sentence will fix this section by requiring that when these applications are reviewed by the commission, that they must reasonably protect competition, choice, and innovation. We hope to work with the chair and others on an amendment related to this. And we think overall that these small changes really help improve the program and help meet the goals of the entire bill. Obviously, we need more clean air, more clean cars, and more clean fuel in order to meet these goals. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chair,
Excuse me. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, my name is Kristen Sharon. I'm the Oregon Director for Climate Solutions, a regional nonprofit working to accelerate practical and profitable solutions to climate change. I've had the pleasure of being before your committee before on this issue, so I'll be brief. We've heard a lot of testimony today and 2 days ago related to House Bill 4036. I just want to try to summarize where I think we are at this point in time. I think everyone in this room is mostly in agreement that the clean energy transition, the transition to a clean economy, is as desirable as it is inevitable at this point. So the question for Oregon is how and when. House Bill 4036 represents a package of public policy that has earned the support of the two largest utilities who reliably and affordably provide power to 70% of the homes and businesses in the state. It has earned the support of the ratepayer advocate CUB, who has saved ratepayers millions of dollars over the course of its existence. It has earned the support of businesses, as we've heard from the Oregon Business Alliance, and as you see, hundreds of other businesses across the state. It has earned the support of environmental and clean energy advocates, and most importantly, this bill has earned the support, as recent polling released to the press just this week has shown, of over 70% of Oregonians, not just for a coal to clean energy transition, but for this bill specifically. We have a lot of work to do to transition Oregon to a clean economy. The ability of this legislature to deal with this issue, to take this important next big step now and resolve it this way, will set an important precedent for how we can all work together moving forward to advance the clean economy transition. So I urge your support for this bill, and thank you for listening to my testimony.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. So we have one more panel. I know we're a little bit over. We'll try to finish up in about 10 minutes. So I have left on the sheet from today, Jael Wilson, Megan Schrader. Is there anybody else who is here who didn't sign up on this new sheet that wants to testify? Okay. Ricky, you can come on up. Okay. Well, you can come up. She was on the other bill. Can we get one more chair? Yep. That's perfect. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Megan Schrader. I'm the Executive Director of TechNet in the Northwest region. TechNet represents over 70 of the nation's leading companies in the fields of information technology, internet and social media, venture capital, and green technology. We strongly support advancing clean energy, energy efficiency, and clean transportation technologies, and we applaud the leadership of this committee and groups involved in crafting this legislation to advance these goals. However, though we support the concepts in House Bill 4036, TechNet believes that two amendments are needed to strengthen customer choice and protect private sector innovation. First, TechNet members have strong commitments to using renewable energy for their operations. One of the challenges of growing technology facilities in Oregon has been the ability to procure renewable energy as cost-effectively as has been done in many neighboring states. There's an amendment in the process of being drafted that would promote renewables sooner than the current bill draft by allowing for direct access to procure renewables in the near term, long before the bill's contemplated increases in 2025. Direct access would be a tremendous economic development tool to attract new customers to Oregon who need renewable energy as a fundamental requirement of their business operations. Although some form of direct access exists currently, the transition charges applied to those make it cost prohibitive to those who would like take advantage and use them. This amendment will address this issue, incentivize new investment, and expand consumer choice. Second, as it relates to utilities and electric vehicle charging stations, TechNet has concerns that the proposal as currently drafted doesn't give adequate power to the Oregon PUC to ensure competition and consumer choice. Drivers should be able to charge their electric vehicles at workplaces, grocery stores, malls, parks, and many other locations around the state. And we think this will not only help reduce greenhouse gases, but also drive innovation and create jobs. And how this goal is achieved is critically important. As a state, we have a very important choice to make, and if we will rely on an antiquated command and control regulatory model to give utilities monopoly power to achieve the goal, or will we create a network of stations that can compete on price, location, and service? We think the latter approach allows for innovation and expanded choice for consumers. Taken together, we believe that the current proposal threatens the development of EV charging technology and ultimately our ability to meet these important goals. So we recommend a modest amendment that I think is in the process of being drafted or there's some draft language available. That would include that Oregon's EV charging program should be under the auspices of a PUC proceeding to help ensure that the program goes forward with the proper level of oversight and transparency. Without amendments to encourage consumer choice, the bill as drafted will cost consumers more and place a stranglehold on a growing and competitive market. Oregonians deserve to have a choice in energy and technology, and we think these small changes to the bill will ensure that private companies can access the fuels and products that they choose while preserving an innovation and competition in reaching these important goals. Thank you.
Ricky. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. Ricky Seguin, I work as the state director with Environment Oregon. We're a statewide, citizen-based environmental advocacy organization representing over 40,000 Oregonians from all across Oregon. I'm going to make this as quick as possible. Environment Oregon supports this legislation, but with that, strongly recommend the inclusion of Senator Byers' -15 amendments with one change, which I testified on yesterday, which is also present in the Senate version of that community solar bill. But this is related to the community solar section of this larger agreement. Ultimately, there are lots of reasons to support this legislation. And for the environmental benefits, of course, we support it. But if you're also thinking about making sure that renewable energy resources are developed here in Oregon, the community solar section of the bill is of utmost importance to actually be certain that solar arrays are developed here in the state. There's some pretty notable differences between the community solar section of the base bill and Senator Byers' -15 amendments. I'm happy to send to folks or submit the differences we see between the two, but to echo this woman to my left here, there's a lot to be said about customer choice. The -15 amendments allow all types of customers to participate in community solar programs. That's important for financing purposes, for bringing down costs. The -15 amendments include there is a lot of PUC involvement, I guess is how I'll say that, with the PUC certifying community solar projects before they're built. We expect that in the -15 amendments, we'll see more community solar programs, projects developed as the investor-owned utilities will enter into power purchase agreements with all certified community solar projects. That's very different from the base bill where the Public Utility Commission will set the capacity that the utilities will acquire from community solar projects. There's a few other differences, but I want to strongly put our weight behind the -15 amendments with one addition that I wanted to note. The -15 amendments have a bit of language concerning the renewable energy certificates, the RECs. In both versions, the base bill and the amendment, the renewable energy certificates, or the proof that the electricity generated is green or renewable, those go to the subscribers, the owners of the community solar projects. The one part of the amendment that we disagree with also says that utilities who enter into a power purchase agreement with community solar programs can count that electricity generation toward their renewable portfolio standard compliance. We strongly believe that no two participants can own the proof that 1 megawatt hour of electricity is renewable. So we support the amendment, but recommend that the section that also states that utilities can count the REC toward their renewable portfolio standard should be removed. Okay. Happy to explain in more detail.
Thank you, Mr. Charles.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan policy research organization funded entirely through private voluntary contributions. We don't accept any money from the government. My concerns with this bill are that it makes the grid less reliable, makes power more expensive, and causes more environmental harm from generating sources. So to me, this is the trifecta of bad policy. Now, I've asked the assistant to pass out this handout here, which, if you haven't gone on the Bonneville Power Administration website, it's kind of convenient to see generation in real time in 5-minute increments. This is from 2014, but it doesn't really matter. You could go on right now and see the same thing. And what's interesting, the line you have to focus on is the red line. That's load. That's what has to be met in real time, 24/7, 365. And you can see, well, the blue is hydro, which mimics much of the red line. And the green line, the wind, is totally random. Demand goes up, green line goes down. Green line skyrockets up, demand goes down. It's because wind is unreliable. So, you know, when previous proponents of this bill have said there's not really a reliability problem, to me, the green line here, that is the dictionary definition of a reliability problem in the grid. Because, you know, the red line is the beast. You have to feed the beast on its own terms. The beast doesn't care what laws we pass down here, doesn't care about the rhetorical flourishes of the preamble here. The supply and demand has to be in equilibrium all the time. There's no such thing as saying, sorry, the lunch special's gone, you know, you have to wait for 2 hours. No, you have to provide service all the time. So the more you force feed in wind and solar, the randomly failing sources, by definition, you're increasing reliability problems. That's the only logical conclusion. And when people say, oh, out in some gauzy future of 20, 30, or 40, we'll solve this problem. I mean, to me, that's like saying you're going to remarry your ex-spouse over and over and over and think it's going to get a different outcome. You know, that's the triumph of hope over experience. So Section 11 of the bill acknowledges the problem. That's why you have Section 11. It's an off-ramp. It's an escape hatch for the reliability problem that is hardwired into this bill. Is it more expensive? Well, you've always had a cost cap since 2007. Now, why would there be a cost cap? Because it's hardwired into the bill that is going to be more expensive. Why? Well, spinning reserve. Spinning reserve is the backup for all this. And, by the way, I should say page 2 of my handout, this, which you don't see very often because it's constructed by a friend of mine who is a geeky electrical engineer, the red dots represent the every 5-minute readings of the chart for an entire year. So this is roughly 105,000 red dots. Well, most of them are down here. The wind isn't producing anything. Here's a hypothetical of what the demand is. You know, the demand curve is actually different, but if you're above the demand curve, you're spilling water, you're hurting salmon. If you're below it, you're having to ramp up maybe gas plants. This is the wild child. You can't solve this problem. Wind is wind, solar. It's a problem. So you're having to back up all of that with adult sources, nuclear, coal, gas, hydro, biomass, waste energy, garbage burners, anything that provides actual dispatchable energy. You're going to have to pay twice for this. You've created a whole REC industry so utilities can comply. That's another off-ramp. Well, RECs, that's counterfeit electrons. You know, that's not a real thing. That's a subprime market in carbon. You make people pay for RECs. Well, consumers have to pay for the counterfeit electrons. Accelerated depreciation, page 2 of your bill, sections lines 2 through 22, immensely complex sections about accelerated depreciation of utility assets, which I don't pretend to understand. It's mind-numbingly complex, but the people I've talked to who've done this say it will definitely be winners and losers. I suggest you find out who are going to be the losers in that section. Allowed cost recovery for electrical vehicle infrastructure. Okay, someone's got to pay for that, ratepayers. And the final about environmental harm, I've already talked about. When you ramp up the hydro system like a yo-yo, you've got fish problems. You ramp up natural gas generators like a yo-yo. You have increased emissions. They're running all the time, like jet engines on the tarmac. So I guess I'll just conclude by saying the bill has 3 built-in escape hatches. The REC industry, because that's how utilities are actually going to comply with fake electrons. Cost caps and the waiver to comply with NAERC standards, Section 11. And if people think those don't matter, then here's a little thought experiment. Why don't you run out a different bill with all of those escape hatches not in the bill and see if the advocates actually like the bill then? See, but my view is if the bill is moving in a certain direction and you have to have 3 escape hatches built into it, maybe the direction is just the wrong direction. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Jail, did you want to have a chance to testify before we break?
Will we get a chance Tuesday?
Yeah, we could do it Tuesday. Okay. All right. Otherwise, you can come up right now.
I'd rather do it now.
Yeah, let's do it.
Madam Chair, do you mind if I join demand response departments? Do you mind if I?
Were you signed up?
I was. I signed up Tuesday.
What was your name?
Ken Nichols.
Okay. I'm going to ask you guys to all be very brief.
Okay.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I did have you on here, Ken. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm J.O. Wilson, representing industrial customers of Northwest Utilities and the Northwest Food Processors Association, and with me is analyst and counsel for ICNU. I appreciate the platform to give voice to a voice that hasn't been heard in this debate yet, which is the voice of industrial and business ratepayers, and we do not support the bill. And I also, you know, want to put on the record we were not a party to these discussions in terms of our industrial ratepayers. We've got 160 facilities in the state. We've got 170,000 employees in the state. The fact that we weren't a party to this agreement, and I know folks are excited the fact that parties came together, but I want to state very clearly for the record that did not include business ratepayers, the fact that we are on the cutting edge of reducing our own carbon footprints, we do drive the Oregon economy, we do employ 170,000 people, and by the way, we are expected to shoulder the costs of this legislation. You can see why we would certainly raise some red flags. We think that the right policy for this state at this time is to encourage businesses in energy-intensive states to locate to Oregon. That is the right policy. The right policy is a full court press that encourages energy-intensive companies to be here in this state. The reason is because our electricity generation is already largely carbon-free, and certainly more carbon-free than competing states. Depending on the year, EPA numbers suggest 73 to 77% carbon-free. The right policy is to get companies to locate here under our current legal and regulatory scheme. The problem we see with this bill is that because the energy costs here are already below national average, because we do are cost-effective, more cost-effective and environmentally friendly than in other states, that the cost associated with this bill will essentially negate any cost advantages that our state has to offer with regard to energy costs. And I would say it is one of the few competitive advantages that our state has left today. And I don't understand the impetus to cancel that out. As it's been stated before, House Bill 4036 certainly doesn't change the dispatch of any coal. The coal plants in other states will be retired on a schedule totally unrelated to the policy in this bill. All House Bill 4036 does is raise electric rates with no corresponding environmental benefit, or at least a benefit so small as to be negligible. I think we have, from the industrial point of view, every reason to be skeptical that this policy can be enacted under cost caps of 1 to 1.5%, as has been stated. A simple check of headlines over the past 10 years talk about rate shock in the state and rate filings of 9%, 30%, 20%, all citing investments in energy, renewable energy infrastructure.
Okay, thank you. We can go ahead.
Chair Vega-Peterson, my name is Tyler Peppel. I'm an attorney with the law firm Davis & Van Cleve. We represent the industrial customers at the Oregon Public Utility Commission and other places. So I just want to make three quick points, and thank you very much for giving me your time on this. So I'll keep it brief. The first is that the utilities have provided you with a bunch of numbers related to the potential costs of this legislation and the purported savings that customers will see from this as compared to the initiatives. The most important thing to know about these numbers is every one of them is so speculative and contingent that they are essentially meaningless. There is really no way to know what the costs of those provisions are going to be. The other point I think we need to make is that despite the speculative costs impacts of those provisions, there are other provisions in this legislation where the impacts are far more certain, and every one of them is negative for customers. The first is with respect to the acquisition of territory provisions. The League of Cities has already testified on that, so I won't belabor those issues anymore.
The second, however, is this provision that allows the IOUs to automatically recover the costs of expiring production tax credits. Now, this is a provision that overturns a PUC order that was issued no more than 2 months ago, and it was issued in an open public process where the IOUs were well represented. Over the next 5 years, this provision will allow PacifiCorp to collect somewhere between $25 and $30 million in additional costs from its customers. PGE will collect over $40 million in additional costs from its customers without any meaningful review of them. This shifts the risk that the from the utilities to their customers and significantly increases the likelihood that customers will overpay for their utility service. The third is the provision on electric vehicle charging stations. You've also heard about those. I would just note that this requires this would require all customers of the utility to pay the costs of and to return on the investment of these stations, and there is no cost cap in this provision. So these provisions reduce IOU risk, they shift costs to their customers, and increase the IOU, the return the IOUs can return. Now, Representative Widener, I know I am not a public employee, and I am happy to answer your question about whether we think the initiatives are better or this bill is better. The fact that the costs in the initiative or the RPS and coal provisions are at least 10 years out for customers, we have no idea what the world is going to look like at that point. We have no idea what the costs of compliance are going to be. These other provisions, however, PTCs, acquisition of territory, electric vehicle charging stations, those are going to start impacting customers as early as next year. Those are the provisions that actually matter in this bill at this point, as compared to the initiatives. And I would say that because the initiatives are at least 10 years out, we have time to fix the problems with it. And I would say as a caveat that we certainly do not support those initiatives either. The last point I'm just going to make very quickly is that this is an extremely complex bill. It has all sorts of subtle provisions that are likely to have major implications for the costs that customers have to bear. These include things like decommissioning and remediation costs for coal plants, REC banking provisions that incentivize the IOUs to build generation before they have to. For PacifiCorp in particular, how the utility's multi-state allocation methodology will influence how the costs of resources built to comply with the RPS are allocated to Oregon customers. All of these things are extremely complex, and we simply do not have the time in this short legislative session to fully understand their implications. So that's thank you very much. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Ken Nichols with EQL Energy Energy Consultancy in Portland, Oregon. I'm here representing the Joint Demand Response Parties, a group of companies that provide energy service and demand response to customers and utilities throughout North America. New term, demand response. I'm not sure how comfortable you all are with that, but I just quickly wanted to share our thoughts and lessons learned because it's a relatively established program across the country. Demand response, it's kind of like energy efficiency, but it has a time and a coordinated sense. So it provides grid services, provides reducing peak power demands, et cetera. And so when you're speaking about renewable energy and integrating renewable energy, demand response is a demand-side measure that helps that. And we want to offer, we support the bill, but want to offer some suggestions on language that we think will be helpful. First of all, Section 17 discusses demand response, but it doesn't actually say all cost-effective demand-side measures. It does say all cost-effective energy efficiency, yet it stops short on demand response and says something like pursue and plan for acquisition versus pursue and plan for all. So it's subtle, but yet I think it's an important language change that sets a direction for the state to pursue all cost-effective demand response. Just to give you a sense, the Pacific Northwest is generally way behind in providing these kind of services to customers and utilizing it for utilities. In North America, there's 60,000 megawatts of demand response. The Northwest Power and Conservation Council, which does a regional plan for the Northwest, suggested that the potential in the Northwest is 4,300 megawatts of demand response. And they've made narratives that basically say with no demand response in the Pacific Northwest, you'll build more gas generation. So people are talking about reliability, fluctuating, renewable. Well, demand response is one of those mechanisms to let the demand side of the equation participate in integrating more renewables. In Oregon, PGE began demand response efforts in 2003. They had an RFP in 2008 for demand response for 50 megawatts. To date, they have 10 megawatts in their program. PacifiCorp doesn't mention it anywhere in their solution, and they've done no demand response in Oregon. We think Oregon leads the nation. Oregon and the Northwest leads the nation in energy efficiency. We think demand response is a program that works well with energy efficiency programs and energy service projects, and we encourage these language changes. We'd also like to say that the EV charging issues that came up, we'd also support any utility investment in EV charging would only be done if it did not contribute to distribution or system peaks, which is basically saying if somebody comes home at 5 o'clock and plugs that car in, and it's a winter and the winter peak is happening at 5 or 6 in the afternoon, now you have electric cars or vehicles and transportation contributing to a peak. And guess what? That means you've got to upgrade your transformers, distribution system, substation, and potentially have resources online to accommodate that. On Tuesday, PGE suggested that with 2,000 megawatts of average demand, they need 6,000 megawatts, right? Threefold, if you remember that. Well, demand response is just one of those tools that can help utilize the capacity, reduce the cost of infrastructure and resources. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, any questions? Okay, thank you. With that, I'm gonna close the public hearing on House Bill 4036 and close the committee hearing. 36 and close the committee hearing. Hearing on House Bill 40.